Bush's foreign policy team had always held Saddam in low regard. They saw him as a destabilizing force in the Middle East, a region with vast oil reserves that represented a key national security interest of the United States. Even before 9/11, the Bush team advocated tougher measures against the Iraqi regime than those employed by the Clinton administration. That is why the administration had been pursuing smart sanctions through the UN and moving toward more robust military strikes, if necessary, to keep Saddam in line and perhaps even mortally weaken his regime. But after 9/11, the president and his team took an even closer look at Iraq. They quickly came to view the war on terror as a broad war with many fronts, militarily and non-militarily, potentially including an invasion of Iraq. This was why Bush pulled Rumsfeld aside in a private, one-on-one discussion in late November 2001, as author Bob Woodward confirmed with the president and instructed him to update the Pentagon's war plans for Iraq. Bush made sure this initiative was closely held, known only by a few people who could be trusted not to leak it. But it meant that, in effect, Bush had already made the decision to go to war, even if he convinced himself it might still be avoided. In the back of his mind, he would be convinced on Iraq, as on other issues, that until he gave the final order to commence war, the decision was never final. But as I would learn upon reflection, war was inevitable given the course of action the president set from the beginning. President Bush has always been an instinctive leader, more than an intellectual leader. He is not one to delve deeply into all the possible policy options, including sitting around engaging in extended debate about them, before making a choice. Rather, he chooses based on his gut and his most deeply held convictions. Such was the case with Iraq. One core belief Bush holds is that all people have a God-given right to live in freedom. There is nothing I would ever see him talk more passionately about than this view, both publicly and privately. Another core belief is his deep disdain for tyrants like Saddam Hussein and his well-grounded belief that tyrants never give up their desire to possess the world's most deadly weapons. To the president, Saddam was an international pariah who was guilty of grave atrocities against humanity. This alone put Iraq on the president's radar screen from the start of his administration. Bush also believes that America has an obligation to use its power to lead the rest of the world toward a better and more secure future. And he believes a leader should think and act boldly to strive for the ideal. Therefore, Bush believes it's important for his advisors to think about specific actions in terms of larger strategic objectives, how they fit into the bigger picture of what the administration seeks to accomplish. Finally, Bush was genuinely concerned about America being hit by terrorists again. The anthrax attacks had only heightened those concerns. Bush meant it when he said he would never forget the lesson of 9/11. He was determined to act before potential threats fully materialized. When these beliefs were combined in the post-9/11 environment, the result was the most consequential decision of Bush's presidency. The line between the Bush National Security Team's pre-existing desire to see Saddam gone and a new emphasis on acting against real and growing threats before they are imminent was quickly disappearing. Did Bush's National Security Advisor Condi Rice fully calibrate for Bush's headstrong style of leadership or appreciate the need to keep his beliefs in proper check? That will be for historians to judge. But overall, Bush's foreign policy advisors played right into his thinking, doing little to question it or to cause him to pause long enough to fully consider the consequences before moving forward. And once Bush set a course of action, it was rarely questioned. That is what Bush expected and made known to his top advisors. The strategy for carrying out a policy was open for debate, but there would be no hand-wringing, no second-guessing of the policy once it was decided and set in motion. That was certainly the case with Iraq. Bush was ready to bring about regime change, and that, in all likelihood, meant war. The question now was not whether, but merely when and how. Although I didn't realize it at the time we launched our campaign to sell the war, what drove Bush toward military confrontation more than anything else was an ambitious and idealistic post-9/11 vision of transforming the Middle East through the spread of freedom. This view was grounded in a philosophy of coercive democracy, a belief that Iraq was ripe for conversion from a dictatorship into a beacon of liberty through the use of force, and a conviction that this could be achieved at nominal cost. The Iraqis were understood to be modern, forward-looking people who yearned for liberty but couldn't achieve it under the brutal, tyrannical regime of Saddam Hussein. The president and his leadership team believed that victory in Iraq could be achieved swiftly and decisively, and that the Iraqi people would then welcome and embrace freedom. Once democracy was established in Iraq, the president and his advisors believed it would serve as an example to other freedom-seeking reformers in the Middle East. They believed that this positive domino effect might impact neighboring Iran, which, like Iraq, had a significant number of well-educated, forward-looking citizens, particularly among younger people. Afghanistan was already on the verge of democracy. It bordered one side of Iran, and Iraq bordered another. A free Iraq would further help inspire and embolden reform-minded Iranians to rise up and change their country's governance, and a free Iraq and a free Iran would remove two major threats to peace and stability in the heart of the Middle East, two parts of the axis of evil Bush had highlighted in his January 2002 State of the Union address. And this, in turn, would dramatically reduce global tensions and enhance a key national security interest of the United States by ensuring the long-term stability of the massive oil reserves of the Middle East. As President Bush likes to say, free countries are peaceful countries that don't go to war with one another. So bringing freedom to the Middle East would be a huge step toward building a more peaceful 21st century world. The president had long believed in advancing freedom and democracy around the world, including in the Middle East, and had articulated his commitment to that vision as early as his Warsaw speech of June 2001. At the time, however, no serious consideration was being given to a large-scale military invasion to coercively advance such thinking. But 9/11 led him to focus just such an idea on Iraq. Bush's belief in advancing liberty globally was one reason he favored a resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli issue through the creation of a free Palestinian state, another step that would be beneficial to building a freer, more stable Middle East that would be less likely to export terror. For Bush, a free Iraq became a greater priority post-9/11 because it was more quickly achievable than solving the Palestinian-Israeli dispute. I recall a conversation I had with the president in the Oval Office a couple of years later when I was press secretary. At the time, the storyline was first emerging among the media that the outcome in Iraq would determine his legacy more than anything else. I asked Bush about this. He quickly and confidently replied, "No, the war on terror will determine my legacy, and how Iraq fits into that will determine my legacy." In his grand vision, a free Middle East would offer hope and opportunity to the citizens of a region that had seen too little of either. This, in turn, would diminish the ability of radical Islamic terrorists to foment hatred and violence and to recruit followers from the downtrodden, poverty-stricken, and poorly educated people in the region. It would ultimately mean prevailing in the war on terror, and Bush's place in history would be cemented. The president's dream of a democratic Middle East was shared by several key administration officials, such as Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz and his neoconservative intellectual supporters. As for Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, my sense is that they were mainly interested in eliminating a threat to regional and global peace and greater economic security, and a little less enthralled by Bush's vision of a world transformed by freedom. But they didn't disapprove of the democratic vision, and if it helped strengthen the president's commitment to a military mission they supported for other reasons, they were happy to sign on. But during the campaign for war, this transformational vision for the region was downplayed by both the president and other members of his administration. Instead, they emphasized the threat of WMD and the possible link between Iraq and terrorism. As Wolfowitz would tell Vanity Fair in May 2003, Bush and his national security team settled on the one issue that everyone could agree on, which was weapons of mass destruction as the core reason. Wolfowitz went on to say, "There have always been three fundamental concerns about Iraq. One is weapons of mass destruction. The second is support for terrorism. The third is the criminal treatment of the Iraqi people. Actually, I guess you could say there's a fourth overriding one, which is the connection between the first two. The third one by itself, as I think I said earlier, is a reason to help the Iraqis. But it's not a reason to put Americans' kids' lives at risk, certainly not on the scale we did it. He also acknowledged that the issue about links to terrorism is the one about which there's the most disagreement within the bureaucracy.